Chapter 6. Wednesday is spiraling out of control. On this fourth day of the experiment, I am looking forward to a less frenetic time than Tuesday's endless troubles had created. Our daily schedule seems filled with enough interesting events to contain the volatility that has been bursting the seams of our prison. A priest who had been a prison chaplain is coming to visit this morning to give me a sense of how realistic our prison simulation is to provide a benchmark, the actual prison experience, against which to measure ourselves. He is reciprocating an earlier favor I did for him, providing some references for a paper he was writing on prisons for a summer school course. Although his visit was arranged prior to the start of our study, it will do double duty by also partially satisfying the grievance committee's demand for church services, sort of. Afterward, there will be the first parole board hearing for prisoners requesting to be paroled. The board is going to be headed by our prison consultant on this project, Carlo Prescott. It will be interesting to see how he deals with this total role inversion from a former prisoner who had repeatedly requested parole and been rejected to the head of a parole board. The promise of another visiting night after dinner should help to contain the distress of some prisoners. I also plan to admit a replacement prisoner in uniform number 416 to fill the vacancy of troublesome Doug 8612. A lot of action is on today's agenda, but it is all in a good day's work for the superintendent of the Stanford County Jail and his staff. A priestly puzzle. Father McDermott is a big man, about 6 feet 2 inches tall. He is slim and trim, looks as if he does regular gym time. His receding hairline gives his face more territory to show off his big smile, finely crafted nose, and ruddy complexion. He stands straight, sits erect, and has a good sense of humor. McDermott is an Irish Catholic priest in his late 40s who has had experience as a pastoral counselor in an East Coast prison. With his starched collar and neatly pressed black suit, he is the movie version of the jovial yet firm parish priest. I'm amazed at the fluidity with which he slips into and out of his priestly role. Now he is the serious scholar, now the concerned priest, now someone making a professional contact, but always he returns to his leading role as the priest man. In the superintendent's office, we go over the long list of references with annotations that I've prepared for him to help on a report he is doing on interpersonal violence. He is obviously impressed that I am taking so much time with him and pleased by the reference list. So he asks, "What can I do to help you?" I respond, "All I would like is for you to talk with as many of the student subjects in our experiment as possible in the time you have available, and then, on the basis of what they tell you and what you observe, give me your honest evaluation of how realistic their prison experience seems to you."
"Sure. Pleased to reciprocate. I will use as my comparison base the prisoners I worked with in a Washington, D.C. correctional facility I was assigned to for several years," the father tells me.
"Great. I very much appreciate your assistance." Now, it's time for me to switch hats. The warden has invited any inmates who want to talk with a minister to register for that privilege. A number of them do want to talk with you, and some want to request that religious services be held here this weekend. Only one prisoner, number 819, is feeling sick and wants more sleep, so he won't be talking with you.
"Okay, let's go. Should be interesting," says Father McDermott.
The warden has set a pair of chairs against the wall between cells 2 and 3 for the priest and each inmate who comes to him. I bring over another for me to sit on next to the priest. Jaffe is at my side, looking very serious as he personally escorts each inmate from his cell to the interview. Jaffe is obviously relishing the mock reality of this scenario with a real priest enacting his pastoral role with our mock prisoners. He really gets into it. I am more concerned about the prisoner's likely complaints and what the good father is likely to do to correct them. I ask Jaffe to be sure that Kurt Banks is getting this on video as close up as possible, but the low-level quality of our video camera doesn't allow close-ups as tight as I would like. Most interactions take the same form. The priest introduces himself.
Father McDermott, son. And you?
The prisoner responds. I'm 5486, sir.
Or,
I'm 7258, father.
Only a few respond with their names. The rest just give him their numbers instead of their names. Curiously, the priest does not flinch. I'm very surprised. Socialization into the prisoner role is clearly taking effect.
What are you charged with?
Burglary.
Or
armed robbery.
Or
breaking and entering.
Or
459 code violation.
Are the usual replies.
Some add, but I'm innocent.
Or I was charged with, but did not do it, sir. The priest then says, good to see you, young man. Or says the prisoner's first name. He inquires about where he lives, about his family, about visitors.
Why is the chain on your leg?
Asks Father McDermott of one prisoner.
I think it's to prevent us from moving around that freely,
is the response. Some he asks about how they are being treated, how they are feeling, whether they have any complaints, and whether he can offer any assistance. Then our priest goes beyond any of my expectations with basic questions about the legal aspect of their confinement.
Anybody post bond for you?
He asks one of them. Alternatively, of 4325, he seriously inquires,
how does your lawyer feel about your case?
For variety's sake, he asks others,
have you told your family about the charges against you?
Or,
have you seen the public defender yet?
Suddenly, we are all in the twilight zone. Father McDermott himself has slipped deeply into the role of prison chaplain. Apparently, our mock prison has created a very realistic situation that has drawn the priest in, just as it has the prisoners and the guards and me.
We weren't allowed to make a phone call, and we have not yet been brought to trial. No trial date has even been mentioned, sir.
The priest says,
well, someone has got to take your case. I mean, you can fight it from here, but what good does it do to simply write the criminal court chief justice? It is going to be very slow to get a response. You want your family making this contact with a lawyer, because you don't have much pull at all in your current state.
Prisoner Rich, 1037, says that he plans to
be my own lawyer, because I'll be a lawyer soon after I finish law school in a few years.
The priest smiles sardonically.
It is my general observation that a lawyer who tries his own case tends to be too emotionally involved. You know the old saying, anyone who represents himself has a fool for an attorney.
I tell 1037 that his time is up, and motion to the warden to replace him with the next prisoner. The priest is taken aback by Sarge's excessive formality and his refusal to consider getting legal counsel because
it is only fair that I serve the time I have coming for the crime I am alleged to have committed.
Are there others like him, or is he a special case?
McDermott asks.
He's our special case, Father.
It is hard to like Sarge. Even the priest treats him in a patronizing manner. Prisoner Paul, 5704, slickly exploits this opportunity to bum a cigarette from the priest, knowing that he is not allowed to smoke. As he lights up and takes a deep puff, he gives me a shit-eating grin and a big victory sign, his nonverbal gotcha. The head of the grievance committee is making the most of this pleasant respite from the prison routine. I expect him next to ask for another smoke for later. However, I notice that Guard Arnett is duly taking note of this affront and know that he will make the prisoner pay dearly for the contraband cigarette and his wise Alex smirk. As the interviews proceed, one after another, in small talk, complaints about mistreatment and violations of the rules, I am becoming ever more agitated and confused. Only prisoner 5486 refuses to be sucked into this scenario, namely to play-acting that this is a real prison and he is a real prisoner who needs a real priest's help to get his freedom back. He is the only one who describes the situation as an experiment, one that is getting out of control. Jerry, 5486, is the most level-headed guy in the mix, but the least demonstrative. I realize that he has been a shadow until now, not usually called upon by the guards on any shift for special action, and rarely even noticeable in any count, the rebellion, or disturbances so far. I will keep my eye on him from now on. The next prisoner, by contrast, is eager to have the priest help get him legal assistance. However, he is stunned by the awareness that it costs big money.
Well, suppose your attorney wanted $500 as a retainer right now. Do you have $500 on you? If not, your parents are going to have to come up with that, and more, right away.
Prisoner Hubby, 7258, accepts the priest's offer of assistance and gives him his mother's name and phone number so that she can arrange for legal help. He says that his cousin is in the local public defender's office, and he might be available to bail him out. Father McDermott promises to follow through on this request, and Hubby lights up as if he were Santa Claus giving him a new car. The whole production is becoming ever more weird. Before leaving, and after having talked in earnest with seven of our inmates, the priest, in best priestly fashion, asks about the one reluctant prisoner, who might need his help. I ask Guard Arnett to encourage 819 to take a few minutes to talk with the priest. It might help him feel better. During a lull, while prisoner 819 is being prepared for his meeting with the pastoral counselor, Father McDermott confides in me.
They are all the naive type of prisoner. They don't know anything about prison or what a prison's for. It's typical of the educated people that I see. These are the people you want to try to change the prison system, tomorrow's leaders and today's voters, and they are the ones who are going to shape community education. They just don't know enough about what prisons are and what they can do to a person. But what you're doing here is good. It'll teach them.
I take this as a vote of confidence, register his homily for the day, but am no less confused. Prisoner Stu, 819, is looking terrible, to say the least. Dark circles under his eyes, uncombed hair going in every direction but down. This morning, Stu, 819, did a bad thing. In a rage, he messed up his cell, tearing open the pillow and throwing the feathers everywhere. He was put in the hole, and his cellmates had to clean up the mess. He has been depressed following his parents' visit last night. One of his buddies told a guard that while his parents thought that they had had a great talk with him, he felt otherwise. They had not listened to his complaints, and they had not cared about his condition, which he had tried to explain to them, but they had just talked on and on about some damn play they had just seen. Priest.
I wonder if you had discussed the idea that your family might get a lawyer for you.
819. They knew I was a prisoner. I told them what I was doing here, about the numbers, the regulations, the hassles.
Priest. How do you feel now?
819. I have a bad headache. I need a doctor. I intervene, trying to discover the basis of his headache. I ask him whether it was a typical migraine, or maybe had been caused by exhaustion, hunger, heat, stress, constipation, or vision problems. 819. I just feel kind of drained, nervous. Then he breaks down and starts to cry. Big tears, big heaving sighs. The priest calmly gives him his handkerchief to wipe the tears away.
Now there, it can't be all that bad. How long have you been in this place?
Only 3 days.
You're going to have to be less emotional.
I try to comfort 819, arranging for him to take a time out in the restroom off the yard, actually behind the partition where we are doing our tape recording. I tell him that he can rest comfortably, and I will get him some good food. Then we'll see if the headache goes away by this afternoon. If not, I will take him to student health for a checkup. I end by getting him to promise not to try to escape, because I am taking him to a minimum security area. I ask him whether he is really feeling so bad that he should be released now. He insists that he wants to continue, and agrees not to try any funny business. Priest to 819.
Maybe you are responding to the smell of this place. The air here is oppressive.
There's an unpleasant smell. It takes time to get used to it. Nevertheless, it's there. It has sort of a toxic quality. Maybe that's too strong, but the stench brings home the reality of prison.
McDermott is smelling the urine and feces odor now clinging to our prison, to which we are habituated and don't notice until it is called to our attention.
You have to get your balance. Plenty of prisoners learn to handle it.
As we walk off the yard, down the hall to my office, the priest tells me that the study is working like a real prison, and specifically that he is seeing the typical first offender syndrome, one filled with confusion, irritability, rage, depression, and over-emotionalization. He assures me that such reactions change after a week or so, because it does not aid a prisoner's survival to be so effeminate. He adds that he thinks this situation is more real for 819 than the boy is willing to admit. We agree that he needs counseling. I note that although 819's lips were trembling, hands shaking, and eyes tearing, he still could not admit that he cannot make it here, that he wants out. I think that he cannot accept the idea that he is chickening out, that his masculinity might be threatened, so he wants us, wants me, to insist that he leave as a way of saving face.
Maybe so. That is an interesting possibility, Father McDermott adds, reflecting on all that has just transpired.
While I bid him adieu, I add in passing that the good father is not really going to call the parents, right?
Of course I am. I must. It is my duty.
Sure. How stupid of me. Your duty. That's right. Just what I need is parents and lawyers to deal with, because a priest made a promise he is obligated to keep in his role as a real priest, even though he knows this is not a real prison, and they are not real prisoners, but what the hell, the play must go on. The priest's visit highlights the growing confusion here between reality and illusion, between role-playing and self-determined identity. He is a real priest in the real world, with personal experience in real prisons, and although he is fully aware that ours is a mock prison, he so fully and deeply enacts his assumed role that he helps to transform our show into reality. He sits erect, holds his hands in a particular way, gestures just so, leans forward to give personal advice, nods knowingly, pats shoulders, scowls at prisoners' foolishness, and talks in tones and cadences that take me back to my childhood in Sunday school at St. Anselm's Catholic Church. He could not present a more perfect image of a priest had he been sent from Central Casting. While he was doing his priestly thing, it was as though we were on a bizarre movie set, and I admired how well this actor performed his role. If anything, the priestly visit further transformed our simulated experiment into an ever more realistic prison. This was especially so for those prisoners who had been able to sustain the realization that this is all just an experiment. The priest has made his message a new medium. Is our scenario now in the hands of Franz Kafka or Luigi Pirandello? Just then, an eruption booms from the yard. The prisoners are shouting. They are chanting loudly something about Prisoner 819. Arnett.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Say it 10 times, loudly.
Prisoners.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing.
Over and over many times.
Arnett.
What is happening to Prisoner 819 for doing the bad thing he did? Prisoner 3401?
3401.
Prisoner 819 is being punished.
Arnett.
What is happening to Prisoner 819? 1037.
1037.
I'm not sure, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Arnett.
He's being punished. From the top, 3401.
3401 repeats the mantra, as 1037 adds even louder,
Prisoner 819 is being punished, Mr. Correctional Officer.
1037 and each of the other prisoners is asked the same question in turn, and each responds identically, individually, and then collectively.
Arnett. Let's hear it 5 times to make sure you remember it. Because of the bad things that Prisoner 819 did,
Your cells are a mess. Let's hear it 10 times.
Because of what prisoner 819 did, my cell is a mess.
The prisoners chant the phrase repeatedly, but 1037, the one who plans to be a lawyer, is no longer joining in. Guard John Landry gestures menacingly at him with his billy club to get with the program. Arnett stops the chant to ask what is wrong. Landry informs him of 1037's disobedience. Prisoner 1037 challenges Arnett.
I have a question, Mr. Correctional Officer. Are we supposed to never tell lies?
Arnett, in his most formal, unflustered, totally authentic style, replies,
We're not interested in your questions now. The task has been assigned. Now let's hear it. Because of what prisoner 819 did, my cell is a mess. 10 times.
Prisoners chant the phrase but lose track and do so 11 times. Arnett.
How many times were you told to do that, prisoner 3401?
3401.
10 times.
Arnett.
How many times did you do it, Mr. 3401?
3401.
10 times, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Arnett.
Wrong. You all did it 11 times. Do it over again. Do it properly. Do it 10 times as I have commanded you to do. Because of what prisoner 819 did, my cell is a mess. 10 times.
They shouted out in precision exactly 10 more times. Arnett.
Everyone assume the position.
Without a moment's hesitation, everyone falls to the ground for push-ups.
Down, up, down, up. 5, 4, 8, 6. These aren't belly rolls, they're push-ups. Keep that back straight. Down, up, down, up, down, and stay down. Roll over on your backs for leg lifts.
Arnett.
6 inches is the most important feature of this, men. Everybody goes 6 inches, and everybody's leg will stay there until everybody's leg is 6 inches.
Guard J. Landry measures to determine whether each prisoner's legs are lifted exactly 6 inches above the ground. Arnett.
All together, 10 times. I will not make the mistake that 819 did, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Arnett.
Now at the absolute top of your lungs. I will not make any mistakes, Mr. Correctional Officer.
They all obey in perfect unison. Prisoner 1037 refuses to shout, but goes along with the chanting nevertheless, while Sarge is delighting in the chance to shout out his obedience to this authority. Then all sing out very politely in response to the officer's final command.
Thank you very much for this nice count, Mr. Correctional Officer.
The precise union of the prisoners would be the envy of any choir master or Hitler Youth Rally leader, I think to myself. Moreover, how far have they, or we, come since Sunday's giggling counts and the playful antics of the new prisoners? You're not 819. It's time to go home, Stuart. When I realized that 819 might be hearing all of this in the R&R room on the other side of the thin partition, I rushed to check on him. What I find is 819 hunched over into a quivering mass, hysterical. I put my arms around him, trying to comfort him, assuring him that he will be all right once he has left and gone home. To my surprise, he refuses to leave with me to see a doctor and then go home.
No, I can't leave. I have to go back in there,
he insists through his tears. He can't leave, knowing that the other prisoners have labeled him a bad prisoner, that messing up his cell has made all this harassment come down upon them. Even though he is clearly distressed, he is willing to go back into that prison to prove that he is not really a bad guy. Listen carefully to me now. You're not 819. You are Stuart. And my name is Dr. Zimbardo. I am a psychologist, not a prison superintendent, and this is not a real prison. This is just an experiment, and those guys in there are just students like you. So it's time to go home, Stuart. Come with me now. Let's go. He stops sobbing, wipes away the tears, straightens up, and looks into my eyes. He looks like a small child awakening from a nightmare, assured by his parents that it is not a real monster and that everything will be fine once he fully accepts that truth. Okay, Stu, let's go. I have broken through his illusion, but mine is still clinging on. On the way to getting his civilian clothes and mustering Stu out of service, I recall that his day started out with a lot of trouble that set the stage for this emotional breakdown. 819 messes up early on. The warden's log reports that 819 refused to get up at the 6:10 a.m. wake-up. He was put in the hole and later given only half the time in the bathroom that the others got. All, including 819, were present for the 15-minute number count at 7:30, reciting it forward and in reverse repeatedly. However, during the exercise period, 819 refused. A guard came up with the social punishment of forcing the other prisoners to stand with their arms outstretched until 819 yielded. 819 would not yield, and the other prisoners' strength gave out as their arms dropped to their sides. 819 was put back in the hole, where he ate his breakfast in the dark, but refused to eat his egg. He was released for work duty to clean out the toilets with his bare hands and move boxes back and forth endlessly and mindlessly along with all the prisoners. When he returned to his cell, 819 locked himself in. He refused to clean off the stickers from a blanket thrown into his cell. His cellmates, 4325, and the replacement, 8612, were forced to do extra work until he complied. They moved boxes back and forth from one closet to the other. He did not relent, but demanded to see a doctor. They were getting angry at his obstinance, for which they were suffering. Saros's guard shift report notes, "A prisoner locked himself in his cell. We got our clubs and proceeded to get him out. He wouldn't come out. We made everyone stand up against the wall with their arms straight out. He lay back in his cell and laughed. I didn't think he would do it. We gave up. The rest of the prisoners hated us. I just smiled and did my job." Guard Varnish in his report notes the psychological importance of this prisoner's behavior. 819's apparent indifference to the troubles of his fellow inmates upsets them. Varnish goes on to complain in his report about the lack of clear guidelines for what he could do to the prisoners. "I felt I was uncertain as to the amount of force we could in fact use, and this bothered me as I felt the limits on this case were not clearly defined." Vandy reports a different reaction. "I continue to become more involved than on the preceding day. I enjoyed harassing the prisoners at 2:30 a.m., It pleased my sadistic senses to cause bitterness between us." That is a rather remarkable statement, one that I am sure he would never have made 4 days earlier. Stern Guard Arnett adds in his report, "The only time I felt I could not properly play my role was with 819 and 1037, when they were in such obvious difficulty on some occasions. At these times, I was not as tough as I should have been." Basically, the really oppressive thing about the prison experience is being totally at the mercy of other people who are trying to make things as difficult and unenjoyable for you as possible, Stu, 819, later told me. "I simply can't stand being abused by other people. I developed a strong resentment of the fascist guards and a strong liking for the compassionate ones. I was pleased with the rebelliousness of some prisoners and angered at the complacency and total obedience of others. My sense of time was also affected, since each day's torturous moments seemed quite a bit longer than it would have been if one were enjoying oneself. The worst thing about this experience was the total depression that set in from being constantly hassled and the fact that there was no way of getting out. The best thing was finally being set free." Betrayal by our very own spy. Recall that David, who took over 8612's uniform, was brought into the prison as our spy. Unfortunately for us, he was not providing any useful information because he had become sympathetic to the prisoner's cause and had transferred his allegiance to them in almost a heartbeat. I released him that morning in order to debrief him and get his assessment of what was going on. In his interview with the warden and me, our failed informer made clear his disdain for the guards and his frustration at not being able to mobilize the prisoners to disobey orders. He said that that morning one guard had told him to fill the coffee pot with hot water in the bathroom, but then another guard had dumped it out and made him fill it with cold water, admonishing him for disobeying orders. He hated this chicken shit hazing. He also told us of the time distortion that expanded and contracted events, and had confused him when he was awakened several times during the night for interminable counts. He reported a mental dullness, like a fog surrounding everything.
"The arbitrariness and idiot work by the guards grates on you."
In his new role as informer turned prisoner revolutionary, he told us of his plan to energize his mates for action.
"Today, I decided to be a shitty prisoner. I wanted to get some sort of spirit of resistance going among the prisoners. The punishment of making others do more if any prisoner refuses to work or to come out of a cell works only if the others are willing to do more. I tried to make them resist, but everyone was willing to do what they were told, even to the humiliating task of transferring the contents of one closet to the other and back again, or cleaning the toilet bowls with our bare hands."
David reported that nobody is angry with me or the warden, who is mostly just a crackling voice over the loudspeaker, but he and the others are pissed at the guards. He told one of them this morning,
"Mr. Correctional Officer, do you think that when this job ends, you're going to have enough time to become a human being again?"
For which, of course, he got whole time. He was upset that he failed in this attempt to get the other prisoners to refuse to keep their arms lifted in collective punishment for 819's mess-up. Their arms dropped down eventually, but from fatigue, not disobedience. David's frustrations at not being an effective labor organizer are evident in his report to us.
"Communication lines are severely limited when everybody's screaming so loudly. You can't stop it. But during silent periods, I try to talk with my cellmates, but 819 is always in the hole, and the other guy, 4325, Jim, is a drag and not much to talk to. And you know at meals when it would be a good time to talk to all the guys about not giving in so easily to the guards, you can't talk. It's kind of like the energy stays within you and doesn't really ever get organized into action. I got depressed when one guy tells me, 'I want to get parole. Don't bug me. If you want to stick out your neck, that's cool, but I'm not gonna.'"
David did not give us actionable intelligence, such as about escape plans or where the keys to the handcuffs were hidden. His personal reflections did, however, make evident that a powerful force was operating on the minds of the prisoners to suppress group action against their oppression. They had begun to focus inward to selfishly consider what they had to do singly to survive and maybe score an early parole. Welcome the new prisoner on the block. To replenish our depleted rank of prisoners, we admit a replacement, new prisoner number 416. This latecomer will soon play a remarkable role. We see him first on the video in the corner of the yard. He's come into the prison wearing a shopping bag over his head. He is carefully stripped naked by guard Arnett. He's really skinny, all skin and bones, as my mother used to say. You could count each of his rib bones from a distance of 10 feet. He is a rather pathetic sight, and he has not yet begun to realize what is in store for him. Arnett sprays 416 slowly and systematically all over his body with the alleged delousing powder. On day one, this task was rushed because the guards had to process so many incoming prisoners. Now, given ample time, Arnett turns it into a special cleansing ritual. He pulls the number 416 smock over his head, chains his ankle, and tops him off with a new stocking cap. Voila! The new prisoner is ready for action. Unlike the others, who were gradually acclimated to the daily escalations of arbitrary and hostile guard behavior, 416 is being thrust into this crucible of madness head first, with no time for adjustment.
I was stunned by the arrest procedure. As a standby, I was never booked by the police as the others had been. Called by his secretary to get my papers and report to the lobby of the psychology department before noon. I was really pleased to get the job, glad I had gotten a chance to do it.
Remember, these volunteers were being paid for 2 weeks on the job.
As I was waiting, a guard came out, and after I told him my name, he immediately handcuffed me, put a paper bag over my head, brought me down a flight of stairs, and I had to stand for a while with my hands on the wall, spread-eagled. I had no idea what was going on. I think that I accepted being miserable, but it was much worse than I had expected. I didn't expect to come in and right off be stripped and deloused and struck on my legs with a baton. I decided that I would stay as mentally removed from the guards as I could, while watching the other prisoners playing these social games. I said to myself that I will do my best to keep out of that, but as time went on, I forgot my reasons for being here. I'd come in with reasons, like it'll make me money. Suddenly, 416 has been transformed into a prisoner, and one who is extremely dazed and upset.
Amazing Grace, in the Key of Irony. The new prisoner arrives just in time to hear Arnett dictating a letter that the prisoners must send to their prospective visitors for the next visiting night. As the guard reads out the text, they write it out on the prison stationery provided. Then he asks each of them to repeat parts of it aloud. One formula letter, as dictated, says, "Dear Mother, I've been having a marvelous time. The food is great and there's always lots of fun and games. The officers have treated me very well. They are all swell guys. You would like them, Mother. No need to visit. It's seventh heaven. And put the name there that your mother gave you, whatever that may be. Yours truly, your loving son." Guard Marcus collects them all for later mailing, after, of course, first screening them for forbidden information or incendiary complaints. The prisoners put up with such nonsense because visits have become so important to them after a relative few days without seeing family and friends. That link to the other world needs to be maintained as an assurance that this basement world is not all there is. New trouble starts to percolate around a problem with the door lock in cell 1. 5704, the wise guy who shamelessly bummed a cigarette from the priest earlier today, keeps opening the door to show that he is free to go in and out at any time. In silky smooth style, guard Arnett gets a rope and ties it around the bars and across the wall to connect it to cell 2. He does so methodically, as if it were for a Boy Scout merit badge for knot tying. He whistles the Blue Danube waltz as he rings the rope around the bars of one cell and back to the other cell to prevent either from being opened from inside. Arnett whistles well. John Landry comes into view, using his billy club to twist the rope taut. The two guards smile approvingly at each other for a job well done. Now, no one can go into or out of those two cells until the guards have figured out how to fix that defective lock, which 5704 probably broke.
"No cigarettes for you, 5704, as long as the cell door is blockaded. You're going to be in solitary when you get out."
Rich, 1037, yells out threateningly from cell 2,
"I have a weapon."
Arnett challenges him.
"You don't have a weapon. We can get that cell open any time we want."
Someone calls out,
"He has a needle."
"That's not a very good thing for him to have. We'll have to confiscate it and duly punish him."
Landry pounds his club hard on the doors of all the cells to remind them of who is in charge. Arnett adds his slam on the bars of cell 2, almost smashing the hands of one of the prisoners, who pulls back just in time. Then, as in the rebellion in the morning of day 2, John Landry begins to spray the fire extinguisher with its skin-chilling carbon dioxide exhaust into cell 2. Landry and Marcus push their clubs into the cell bars to keep the inmates away from the barred opening, but a prisoner in cell 2 steals one of their clubs away. They all start mocking the guards. New bedlam is about to break out now that the prisoners have a weapon. Arnett maintains his cool demeanor, and after some discussion, the guards arrange to take a lock from a vacant office and install it on cell one.
Actually, men, it's a one-way street in the last analysis. It's just a matter of how long it takes, he tells them patiently.
Eventually, the guards triumph again, forcing their way into both cells and hauling Big Bad Boy 5704 back into solitary. This time they are taking no chances. They tie him up, hands and feet, using their cord taken off the cell doors, before dumping him into the hold. This uprising forfeits the privilege of lunch for all the prisoners. Too bad for 416, the new guy. He has had only a cup of coffee and a cookie for breakfast. He is hungry and has done nothing but look on in amazement as these bizarre events unfold around him. Would be nice to eat something warm, he thinks. Instead of lunch, the prisoners are all lined up against the wall. Paul, 5704, is hauled out of solitary, but remains bound up and helpless, lying on the floor of the yard. He is on display as a lesson against further thoughts of rebellion. Guard Marcus orders everyone to sing while doing jumping jacks, to the tune of Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Since you guys are in such good voice, we're going to sing Amazing Grace, Arnett tells them. We're just going to do one verse. I'm not going to strain God's credulity.
As the rest of the prisoners assume the position on the floor for push-ups, 416 is singled out for his first public notice.
Here you go. You better memorize this, 416. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, to save a wretch like me. I once was blind, but now I see. In the first hour since God, I'm free.
Arnett resists the correction about in the first hour since God that Paul 5704 offers him from the floor.
That's the way you're going to do it. That line might not be exactly it, but that's the way you're going to do it.
Then he inexplicably changes the last line to, since the first hour I've seen God, I'm free. Arnett, who obviously knows he's a good whistler, then whistles Amazing Grace once through and whistles it all again in perfect tune. Prisoners applaud him in a nice spontaneous gesture of appreciation for his talent, despite despising him for his attitude and assorted cruelty against them. As guards Landry and Marcus lounge back on the table, the prisoners sing the song, but clearly they are out of key and out of unison. Arnett is upset.
Did we scrape these people up from the 6th Street ghetto in San Francisco or something? Let's hear it again.
Troublemaker 5704 makes another attempt to correct the inaccurate wording, but Arnett uses the opportunity to make his point loud and clear.
Of course there's a discrepancy here. You're to do the prison version of Amazing Grace. It does not matter if it's wrong, because the guards are always right. 416, you stand up. Everybody else in the push-up position. 416, while they do push-ups, you sing Amazing Grace, as I have dictated it.
Only a few hours after being imprisoned, 416 is moved to center stage by Arnett, who isolates him from the other prisoners and forces him to perform a mindless task. The video captures this saddest of moments as the scrawny new prisoner sings in a high-pitched voice this song of spiritual freedom. His slackened shoulders and downward glance make evident his extreme discomfort, which worsens when he is corrected and has to repeat the song while the others are forced to keep pushing up and down and up and... The irony of being ordered to sing a song of freedom in this oppressive atmosphere, where his song provides the cadence for mindless push-ups, is not lost on 416. He vows not to be crushed by Arnett or any other guard. It is not clear why Arnett has singled him out this way. Maybe it's just a tactic to get him into the pressure cooker faster. Alternatively, maybe there is something about 416's shabby and scrawny appearance that is offensive to a guard who tends to be meticulous and always well turned out.
Now that you're in a singing mood, 416 will sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat,
while everyone is on their back with legs up in the air. I want it loud enough so that 5704's loved one, Richard Nixon, can hear it, wherever the fuck he is. Legs up. 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 Let's hear it a few more times, especially emphasizing that last line, life is but a dream. Prisoner Hubby, 7258, still hanging on to the ironic moment, asks if they can sing, Prison Life is But a Dream. The prisoners are literally screaming the song at this point, their chests heaving with each word. Life here is ever stranger. Return of the TV Cameraman. Sometime this afternoon, we had a visit from the TV cameraman from local San Francisco station KRON. He was sent down to do a brief follow-up on his Sunday shoot, which had sparked some interest at the station. I restricted him to shooting from behind our observation window and to talking only with the warden and me about the progress of the study. I did not want to have external interference upsetting the dynamic that was emerging between the prisoners and the guards. I wasn't able to see the TV coverage he made that night, because we were all enmeshed in too many more urgent matters that took our full attention, and then some. Farewell day shift, good evening night shift.
Time to get ready for Sunday services,
Arnett tells the prisoners, even though it is only Wednesday.
Everyone get in a circle and hold hands, like a religious ceremony. Say, hi, 416, I'm your buddy, 5704. Then each of you welcome your new comrade.
They continue these greetings around the circle in what amounts to a very tender ceremony. I am surprised that Arnett thought to include this sensitive communal activity. But then he goes and spoils it by having everyone skip around in a circle singing Ring Around the Rosie, with 416 standing alone in the center of the sorry circle. Before leaving for the day, Arnett throws in one more count, in which John Landry takes over dictating how it will be sung. It is 416's first count, and he shakes his head in disbelief at how the others follow every command in haunting unison. Arnett continues his dehumanizing treatment until the very last minute of his shift time.
I've had enough of this. Go back to your cage. Clean up your cells so when visitors come, they won't be nauseated by the sight of it.
He leaves, whistling Amazing Grace. As a parting shot, he adds,
See ya, folks. See you tomorrow, my fans.
Landry adds his 2 cents.
I want you to thank your correctional officers for the time they spent with you today.
They give a reluctant,
Thank you, Mr. Correctional Officers.
John Landry is not buying that shitty thank you and makes them shout it louder as he strides off the yard along with Marcus and Arnett. As they exit stage right, in comes the night shift, featuring John Wayne and his eager crew. The new prisoner, 416, later told us about his fear of the guards.
I was terrified by each new shift of guards.